on 1116 SEN. We're first at the footy every Sunday morning.
From a tactical point of view, it was very smart, and he had very experienced players against two very inexperienced boys.
With full-on footy analysis.
Consistency and all that is fantastic. But at some time during a game, you have to stand up as a coach and say, I'm going to make this move. I'm going to change the course of the game from my position as a coach.
Welcome to Inside Football with Robert Shaw and Mark Fine. For McDonald Merhome, the employment lawyers, 9650 4555.
Good morning, football fans. Oh, boy. My BP must have a hearing loss problem. That was loud, but we are going to come through loud and clear this morning on a nice and clear morning in Melbourne. Crisp, but perfect for football. Certainly perfect to head out to the MCG today to watch a fascinating game between Collingwood and GWS and then double up with Melbourne and St Kilda. All, of course, six games in the split rounds brought to you live on 1116 SEN. But we don't look forward on Inside Football, full-on footy analysis. We look back, and by we, I mean myself, the host, Mark Fine, and, of course, Robert Shaw. I'm going to say for the first time in all the years I've worked with Robert, no introduction needed. Robert, good morning to you.
Good morning, Mark. And while we might look at the average losing score of the teams at 8 goals and the average winning goals of the winning team at 12, we might well say, well, it was a bit pedestrian, the football that we watched. But that was far from the case because it was a enthralling contest starting on Friday night. We saw the hard, experienced coaching of Rodney Eade, first versus last, and how he went about it with the help of some weather conditions. But you watched that closely. Watched the Essendon game. Again, huge amount of possessions for Essendon. Ball use going forward. And, of course, we'll be discussing the whys and wherefores, the rights, the wrongs of the ruck situation with Kyle Ohl and Joe Danaher, so we can have a chat about that against Nat Nui and Sinclair. And the continued development and, I don't know about improvement, but the West Coast Eagles keep getting the job done where not many of us thought that they would make the eight this year. So it was a good round of footy in a different sort of way, Mark.
All the games, as you pointed out, had some value to them. And we'll be looking at all four games. We normally don't go back to a Friday, but over this three-week period where there are games being played, six games per round, and starting next week, of course, over Thursday night as well, we'll be looking back at all four games that have been played by Sunday morning. I'm really interested in the Gold Coast. They have, on two separate occasions, taken disciplinary action against players. That can go. And I ask you, Robert, as a coach, I would have thought it's a risky play for a first-year coach, Rodney Eade, as experienced as he is, first year at the Gold Coast, so there are still hearts and minds to be won. There's obviously a level of commitment that he requires, knowing what is needed to be a premiership team. Even though he's not a premiership coach, he was a premiership player, and he knows what that level of commitment needs to be. So he's been cracking the whip at a club that appears to have had discipline. I'm not saying it was lax under Guy McKenna, but let's just say that these guys thought that they could get away with more than they could. So he comes to a new club. Injuries mean that the side is underperforming or at least well below where people thought they would be on the ladder. And he starts disciplining players, not with warnings, but by giving them time off from the senior team. A, it impacts on the quality of the team that's put on the field. But is it a risky play for a coach to, in that first few months at a new club, say, my way or the highway? Because, let's face it, at Gold Coast, the highway is an option. It seems to be working because their effort over the last 2 weeks, in particular yesterday, in grinding conditions against the biggest, strongest midfield in the competition, which should have been well suited to thrash them in the wet, was outstanding.
Yeah, I guess from my perspective, I was always taught, and whether it's right or wrong, but my teacher was Sheeds, and it was all about never impact on the team, punish the individual. Now, that could be a fine. It could be make-up sessions. And usually the indiscretions were of the minor scale. And then there is the impact on culture and what these decisions have in terms of learning and teaching about professionalism, about doing the right thing by your teammates. You're quite right, Mark, because, you know, the incidents we have seen, you know, you take Charlie Dixon out of your forward line, it's going to impact on the team. Is that fair? Or it's probably not, because it impacts on the immediate. And I guess this is the difference in your question, the immediate versus the long term. Now, Ede's been put up there for a variety of reasons. McKenna did well last year. They dropped their last, their six games. They were in the eight for most of the year. So on the field, they seem to be tracking very, very well. But there was a change made, and the reasons, we don't know the intricate details of why, but they wanted Rodney Ede, and they went and got him. And it has been a disastrous year in the short term, particularly with injuries, and that has been compounded by lack of discipline and lack of professionalism, which has been very much documented on radio, television and the newspaper. So that's my, Mark, if it's an indiscretion that doesn't impact on team culture, if it's a mistake or an error, punish the individual, do not punish his teammates, which you tend to do. But if it is a big picture, a growth, an education or a cultural issue, then you must take a strong stand.
I just got the sense that he was making a stand, and the response to that stand could only be judged on field. I think he's been given the thumbs up by those players that are playing for the Gold Coast, and those players off the field will see that, hey, these kids, some of them real raw bone youngsters, maybe wouldn't have got a game of football had the side been at full strength, are giving it their absolute 100% in the last couple of weeks. So the long-term gains should be there for all to see. And the other fact is that because so many players at the Gold Coast aren't playing at the moment, it's exposing some footballers who will go one of two ways. They'll either grow from the experience and become better AFL footballers for it, or this club will see, Gold Coast will see, well, look, we gave these guys a go. They've had half a season to play football. They're not going to measure up. But one way or the other, once the disappointment of not competing for the eight and being basically passed on the highway by GWS has settled, then I think Gold Coast might be better for the season in the long term, even with all these injuries.
Well, you watch them closely. I haven't had the opportunity to watch them in detail. So what are your observations on the immediate? What do you see that has changed, given they've still got the, basically, you know, their best team on out. What have you seen in the immediate that's taken your attention?
Far more desperate, far more team-oriented football, less individual, less attempts by individuals to
win the game.
Imprint on the game for themselves rather than for the team. Look, Jack Martin's not in the middle. Mitch Hallahan is. Harley Bunnell isn't on a half-forward flank. Andrew Boston is. Harley Bunnell's five times the footballer with natural ability that Andrew Boston will ever be, even though I love Andrew Boston's moustache. Looks like he's been transported from a position amongst the high ranking in the First World War. It's not your standard moustache. It's a beautiful moustache. But his football's not sizzling. But, gee, he puts his body on the line and he certainly tries his guts out. Hallahan's a really good example of the difference between natural ability and desperation and team-oriented football. So hopefully and it's not just those two players. There are other players that have let the team down. McKenzie was back yesterday. He had his first kick, apart from the many kicks he had from behinds, he had his first statistical kick late in the third quarter, but he played well. Now, that's a different Trent McKenzie to the swaggering, cocky McKenzie that had to be dropped after the Melbourne game because he went kick hunting and allowed his opponent in round one, at times Garlett, at times there was another half-forward flanker who had a big day for Melbourne. But basically, he played with an arrogance in round one, not befitting of his standing in football. He's been paired all the way back to being a tight defender. Yeah, he kicks long, and that's great when he's kicking the ball in, but his first job yesterday was close marking of an opponent, and he did well. So it's a different...
And put him on Pavlich, which is a physical mismatch, but they backed his athleticism. But that's a good one. Yeah, you're full-back. You might have been full-back because, Mark, they didn't have anyone else, but the fact is it's a change in philosophy. You know, you've got to do a job for the team, and we know the commentators wax lyrical about you're receiving the ball and you're the best left-foot kick and you penetrate inside 50. So he might be a very good example of the change in philosophy.
You know, a really good SMS just came through. Smartest way to get a contract extension. Make sure your first year is the worst of your three-year contract. Rocket couldn't have done this in year three and kept his job. Well, you don't control... It's true, though.
I don't think he can control the injury factor.
That's right. You can't contrive to have all the injuries and have the sort of year from hell, at least in the first part, that the Gold Coast have had. But you do need to have the nous to make the best of it. And once the team couldn't make the finals... Yeah, if your team is in finals contention, you're expedient. You don't drop players from the side. As Robert Shaw said, you punish the individual then. But if the season is really one to sort wheat from chaff and to instill club values, then you can do it almost with gay abandon if you're not striving, A, to make the finals, and especially if you don't have a coach desperate to keep his job and save his skin, where every loss becomes another nail in his coffin, as was the case with Mick Malthouse. So, yes, much better in year one. If you can contrive to do it, coaches, you've got some good advice there from Nav. Why don't we take a break? North Melbourne-Sydney will be our first match for discussion. We'll also be looking back on Friday night and how the Cats... I put the challenge to Geelong. Well, I did. Just fans did, I think. Football... The football world said to Geelong, are you going to go and defy us again? Are you going to go to Adelaide and beat Port Adelaide, who seem to be on the improve, and once again put yourself in the frame, not only for the top eight, but even potentially for the top four? Well, of course, they replied in the positive, because that's the sort of stuff they're made of. We'll be talking about them later in the program, but as we go to the break, Sydney and North Melbourne, the Swans almost had top spot to go for. Had Gold Coast overcome Fremantle. They got on with the business. North Melbourne certainly weren't easy to shrug. And it was a night of tough football. Robert Shaw will give you the full siren-to-siren analysis after the break.
We're first at the footy every Sunday morning on 1116 SEN. Inside Football. Full-on footy analysis with Robert Shaw and Mark Fine. For McDonald Merhome, the employment lawyers, 9650-4555. And Epworth. Better. Inside Football. North Melbourne.
So join in the chorus and sing it one and all. Join in the chorus.
The Sydney Swans.
North have got to grab it and kick a goal, but they don't. Hand pass to Parker. Oh, brilliant Parker. Weaves his way through four of them. Made them look stupid. Comes to Shaw. Shaw towards Buddy, who marks at centre-half forward. And he can go back and kick a monster goal. He's going the journey. He's going long. He's winning the game.
Yeah, we thought at half-time we were 30 points up and probably gave them a couple of goals, pretty easy ones in the first half, and probably did the same thing in the second half, just gave them a couple of easy ones. But thought that, you know, it was a pretty strong display that first half of football, and they were always going to come, and they had their turn the second half, but were able to kick some important goals at important times that held them at bay.
That was John Longmire speaking on the back of North Melbourne's 16-point victory last night at Etihad Stadium, 14-7, 91 to 10-15, 75, in front of 32,217. The attendance was good. The fight in North Melbourne was okay, but Sydney, Robert Shaw, remained resolute, having set up the game, as John Longmire said, with a strong first half. I do have a nagging doubt about the Sydney Swans, but let me hear your analysis of the game first, and you might allay those fears, otherwise I'll put them to you. 9429 1116, by the way, this morning. Plenty of opportunity to be part of the discussion. We'd love you to do so. 0433 98 11 16 if you want to be heard, but not by voice, by SMS. Robert.
G'day, Mark. Yeah, thanks. Well, it was a really interesting game, and there were some key issues that need to be discussed. I want to go through the scores first. If you look at it in the second half, North Melbourne had 15 scoring shots, 6-9 to 5-2. Because, and while that is good and impressive, they got to within 16 points at the end of the game. But if you were watching the second quarter of this game, you would have thought there's a genuine class gulf here. And there may well be, Mark, because at the 18-minute mark of the second quarter, given the fact that the first quarter was pretty even and it was competitive, North in the first 22 minutes, Sydney went inside 18 times to 3. They did this back on the back of some exhilarating stoppage work, some outside pace of the likes of Jeddah. Their ball movement from stoppages was absolutely brilliant. And you're sitting there thinking this has drifted out to 6 goals and this is on the verge of going to get very, very ugly. If they just had too much pace on the outside. They had too much mobility for North Melbourne, who still rely very strongly on Swallow and Cunnington, Azeeble in tight and close. But Sydney just looked exhilarating. Their ball movement from stoppages and through the middle of the ground must have had the North Melbourne people really sort of shuffling in their seats, because I thought this is going to get really, really interesting after half time. The other factor is the big bloke stood up. I thought Lance Franklin, if you watched his goal kicking early, his first two goals, they were unbelievable kicks for goal, Mark. He was a fair way out. He kicked another one from one step from 50 out, but his kicking accuracy from important set shots was first class. And he got 4 and Goods got 3. Goods played that half forward up to the wing, down to the stoppages. And there was one real bad piece of work by North Melbourne. We'll talk about them a little later, where Goods was totally free at a stoppage at a critical time, ran through, received the ball and kicked a goal. And I was still trying to work out who was on him. Tippett got a couple. And then you look at the Northerners, 2 from Thomas and 2 from Nahas. So in effect, the structure of Sydney's forward line really worked well. Their tools worked really well. Richards and Grundy were able to hold the likes of Petrie got 1, Waite didn't kick 1, Brown didn't hit the scoreboard. And then you had the Franklin Goods Tippett factor up the other end. After half time, North came out. Oh, the interesting, another point I want to talk about, both teams were trying to organise that spare man behind, and I thought, well, who's this going to suit? It helped North in the end because they were able to fight their way back in the game. Sometimes they had the out-and-out spare man, whether it was Ferito or Hansen, or sometimes what they did, they let the forward go up to the stoppage, up to the wing, and then they'd drop off him. That sort of gave Sydney a bit of an advantage around the stoppages. They're a great stoppage side, so they always had an extra one. It also allowed, on the other side of the equation, and we spoke about him last Monday night on the whiteboard, Mark, for those watching Jeremy Laidler play last night, you have every right to ask why wasn't he given it. He was superb across halfback. He took 7 or 8 intercept marks. Good percentages, switched the play, did a really, really good job. I know the paper's not everything, but because he's our SEN man and watches the game very closely, Rowan Connolly gave him second best player on the ground behind Parker. And that shows you his effect. And he slotted in beautifully down there.
Let's take a couple of calls. Yep. 9429 1116. And
I think Jeff's on the mark, right on the ball.
Well, let's go to somebody who is going to be not just a caller, but an integral part of our analysis of this game, Jeff in East Keilor. That's a big rap, Jeff.
Good morning, gents. Look, I was pretty buoyed by North's performance last night. I think there is light at the end of the tunnel, but they just gave up goals too easy, especially in that first half, through mistakes or otherwise. And they were breaking down on the half-forward line. They were getting the ball in, but it was just rebounding back. I think that was an issue, and I mean Parker and Zeeble also have got to be knocking on that elite status door now for sure. Zeeble's efforts was really good. But, no, I was pretty bored with the boys' performance last night. You know, the Swans are right up there in the top two. And, you know, hopefully if we can get Wells and of course, Dalsano back, you know, there is a lot of upside to the rest of the season for them.
Well, I think so. It was an interesting, pardon me, an interesting game to read from both sides because, as you said, there was a class gap at one stage in that second quarter, and you've alluded to that, Jeff, and yet the Swans seemed to get efficient goals. Rapid movement, isolate Franklin, goods into space, find their target. So there seemed to be a class gap, but credit to North Melbourne who really fought back into the game, but they had to work really hard for their goals. And work hard they did on the back of Higgins's, you know, he broke clear in that third quarter. They obviously had to make a statement and make an adjustment. They did a pretty good job, Mark, on Hanbury. They gave Jacobs the job on Hanbury. Hanbury was kept to 11-11. He got a bad knock in his back. It curtailed him a little bit. Jacobs did a very diligent job on him without, I thought, hurting him the other way. And it raises the point that we spoke about the other night with the role of the run with player and the tagger and how you have to hurt them the other way. Jacobs had a very long kick. Only had three kicks. So he didn't hurt Hanbury by kicking, which meant that Hanbury could sort of focus on the ball and his own team, knowing that Jacobs wasn't going to hurt him that much. But it was a diligent and disciplined performance by Jacobs on one of the form players in the competition.
Great call, Jeff. Let's head to Reservoir and Dom. Good morning, Dom.
Oh, good morning, Finey and Rob. How are we going?
Good, Dom. How'd you see it?
Oh, well, look, what I want to point out, right, we are very poor with our conversion. Like our set shot goal kick, and we do kick a lot of points, as I've mentioned quite a few times this year. But as you know, Finey, I've kept a running tally of our six forwards.
Here we go.
Higgins, Thomas, Nahas, and the three tools, Brown, Petrie and Waite, have now kicked 101 of our 138 goals this year, but about 50 or 60 points as well. I'm just thinking, like, at this time of year, if you remember the way Joe Waite finished the year last year for Carlton, coming off a long spell, playing for the Bull Ants, or also missed a couple of weeks, and then he came home strong after a decent spell in the middle of the season. Is it worth giving him a break now for these two interstate games that we've got coming up with the bye in between as well, and maybe bringing back Aaron Black? Although Black yesterday played his best game for North Butterup, but he kicked 2-5. It's just our conversion rate. These guys are, there's no, you know, you're not in the elements that Eddie had, so there's no reason why you should be missing set shots. And unfortunately, our money men, even at the end there, if you get it to within a kick there with Higo from 50, if you get it to within 5 points of the minute and 10 left,
yeah,
it's anyone's game. But at least we're getting it in there, and our forwards, you can't be too critical because they are contributing on the scoreboard, you know, kicking the majority of our score week in, week out.
One of the interesting stats that came out of the game was the scoring from stoppages. I thought North did very well on controlling Sydney, who only kicked 3-3 from stoppages. But on the other side of the equation, Mark, and it's not set shots, but North Melbourne kicked 1-8. So that's backing
terrible.
Up. That's from stoppage clearances. It's hard enough to beat Sydney in the stoppages at the best of times, but if you're going to kick 1-8 from it, geez, you open up the door for them. Good call, Dom. Thanks, mate.
Dom's...
Oh, he's still there.
No. Dom's made some really good points. And actually, Dom, if you are still there, you're there, aren't you?
Yeah, mate. Yep.
Play them or lose them, Aaron Black and Magjack Dore. If you're not going to play them, then they may as well be traded at the end of the season and see what you can get for them. But it seems a worthwhile gambit to certainly, given what Jared Waite has provided thus far, and as you said, not playing him might provide him the opportunity to revitalise. His body has been always part of the equation that concerns. So if you don't play Aaron Black, I know he's probably still got time to run on his contract because he was recontracted a year or so ago, but yeah, then you won't be able to, or you shouldn't retain him. And Magjack Dore kicked 5 goals a couple of weeks ago in the VFL, so he should probably also be given a look at, shouldn't he?
Yeah, look, I agree, Fonny. I'm actually on my way now to Vic Park at 11 o'clock. Werribee play Collingwood, and Majak will be auditioning for a spot next week. This is his big chance. I also want to watch Patch Adams, Luke McDonald, Mason Wood. We've got a fair bit of depth there.
North and, North has plenty of depth. There's no question that there's plenty of depth. The trick now is to pick the right 22, because the second half of the season beckons, and there are three scenarios. A brilliant second half of the season could see barnstorming run into the top four. Unlikely, but not impossible. The most likely scenario is somewhere between fifth and eighth. And if things go pear-shaped, you could miss out on the final. So the trick for Brad Scott is to unlock the puzzle, to unlock and find the key to the best 22, which doesn't necessarily stand out at the moment as obvious. And if anybody thinks it's obvious, then they aren't like Dom and cognizant of the depth at the club, remembering Wells and Del Santo have to come back into the side as well.
No,
I was just saying yesterday, if you look at yesterday, Muller had like 30 possessions running off a halfback flank down at Geelong for North Ballarat, and that's about his fourth or fifth game back now. So Atlee's playing for North Ballarat as well. Taylor Garner's starting to show a bit now that he's played three or four consecutive games returning from a hamstring injury. So I reckon there's a good like five or six spots up for grabs, and there's a lot of players that can come in. But looking at our fixture, and you should never look too far ahead.
I would. GWS away.
Well, of course. But look, there's 11 games. I look at 11 games left.
Yeah.
And I look at it, and other than GWS interstate, which it's an unknown quantity, but Geelong and Freo, both at Etihad, are probably our most our toughest games for the remainder of the season. But I don't see any reason why we can't go out there and just like come home hard and win every game, or attack every game and try and win every game and finish well in the eight, not just scrape in, but make a real impact late in the year.
Well, it is one of the scenarios, but because of the inconsistent nature of North Melbourne and a lot of the teams that you've played this year, Dom, that's only one of three possible outcomes. Probably the most fascinating team in the second half of the season, I would have thought, North. Upside, huge. Downside could be calamitous for individuals both on and off the field. And somewhere in the middle is probably what people expect. But North Melbourne this year have almost conditioned us to expect the unexpected. So from a neutral's point of view, bring it on, North. You are fascinating. Only the future will tell, A, where you finish, of course, on the ladder. That's the same for everybody, but for North, the variations, I think, are great. But more importantly, only the next 11 weeks will probably tell us who the best 22, and then the next three players are at North Melbourne. That is not locked away. Dom, you make great points and are in a good position to do so, given your unstinting and deep support for the club. Great phone call. Just a couple of things about the Swans before we wrap it up. There's a niggling concern for the Swans going forward, because now that they've really hit their stride, and we know that Fremantle, of course, started the season brilliantly, but we just wait to see how deep Freo can go. Sydney are now into the same stride that they were last year when, remember, except for that grand final, what had they won? 11 out of 12, 12 out of 30. They were mighty. They're mighty again. Here's my concern. Their ruckman is getting consistently thrashed. He got completely handled by Tom Nichols. He got handled by Todd Goldstein. It's not getting any better for Mike Pike as the standalone ruckman. And grand finals and preliminary finals can, and in the past, have certainly pivoted on the roles of ruckman. They might not be important week in, week out, even though they do win games. Aaron Sanderlands is in mighty form. His ruck work has gone from comprehensive to telling, because comprehensive meant that he used to just hit the ball before the other guy did. He now has a beacon to hit it to by the name of Nat Fyfe, and they are forming some combination. And if in a preliminary final or a grand final, if that was being held next week between Sanderlands and Pike, then I can tell you that Freo would be getting first years of the ball from 90% of the ruck contests. And it's not easy to go third up against Aaron Sanderlands. Let me tell you, they were trying yesterday. You need ropes and climbing equipment to get up that high. So I'm just concerned. I'm not concerned. I'm interested to know whether or not they can't try Nankervis or Derricks or somebody else to help him or instead of him.
I would look at internally, Mark. I think, and I agree with you. Now, thinking back, Pike has shown a capacity in his 101 games that he can go and take a mark up forward.
Yes, definitely.
Right, he can do that. I would like to say, I think the problem is internal. It's not a problem. I would like to see Tippett used more in the ruck. More in the ruck. A more sharing role, either Pike pushing forward. Now, the reason he can't do that this year is because of the balance of their forward line and the much improved form of Adam Goods and the role they have developed for Reed. Now, every game I've watched, Sydney, Reed starts on the wing and you go, 6'5" winger. That's interesting. But he spends about 3 minutes there, and then he'll either go to a position where Sydney feel they can gain advantage, so he could go forward and get a mismatch, or he can go back and give some support and take, say, like a Jeremy Laidler's man and allow Jeremy Laidler to become the loose man. So they work him very well. So they can't bring a Derricks or a Nankervis into that side. They have to find the second backman, the second ruckman internally, Mark, because of their height and their issues, not issues, positive issues with Reed and Goods. So it has to be more from Tippett.
Well, that's not a bad thing because Tippett was, he blossomed as a footballer and came to notice at Adelaide under Neil Craig as a forward ruckman, ruckman forward. And it seems the more he gets the ball in a game, the better he is. So that's sage advice from our resident sage, Robert Shaw. After the break, we're going to go all the way back to Friday night and have a look at Geelong and Port Adelaide. She was a heck of a game of football by the Cats and some unlikely heroes amongst some regular names. But Geelong have, like North Melbourne, started to put together a deep list. Maybe it's a Scott thing.
We're first at the footy every Sunday morning on 1116 SEN. Inside Football. Full-on footy analysis with Robert Shaw and Mark Fine. For McDonald Merhome, the employment lawyers, 9650 4555. And Epworth, better.
Ball up forward pocket, Cats. Robbie Gray takes the football at ground. Oh, Mudlock stole it up him, threw it onto the boot, goal.
Unbelievable goal.
That's extraordinary. Kicked it out of mid-air, Motlop.
He intercepted it with one tap and kicked it with a one boot.
That is mercurial stuff.
Yes, that was mercurial stuff. And lovingly called by Matty Granlund and Anthony Hudson on 11.16 SEN. We go back to Friday night for a look, a quick look, because we don't normally go back to Friday night football, but we've got a little bit of time. And not as much about the game, even though I'm interested in Shorey's take on how Geelong won the game, but I'm interested in how Geelong, with, let's face it, a list that suggested, especially with injuries to, first of all, Mitch Duncan, who was having a breakout season, a good player, Mitch Duncan, had become a very, very good player before his injury, James Bartel, and more fascinatingly, first, second, third choice ruckman all go down. And they've been able to get plenty out of Reece Stanley. They work blitzavs into the action. If I would have told you on Friday night, right, they're going over to play Port Adelaide. Hawkins will be basically...
goalless.
A duck. Yeah. Did he kick a goal? He might have kicked a... I don't even know if he did.
He got two.
But
well,
they would have been
the first half.
They would have been his kicks.
Yeah.
The...
Ruckman...
Selwood... Selwood would have, in terms of possessions,
Jay Selwood,
one of his lowest games in his career, 17 touches.
Correct. 8 and 9.
That their ruck division would be carried by Reece Stanley, who, by the way, would play well enough to almost be best on ground, even though he didn't play in the last quarter.
Reincarnation of Carl Dittrich.
He was fantastic. But,
he was
but if
fantastic.
I would have told you that Hawkins and Selwood would struggle and the Kelly would be off...
in the first quarter.
Yeah, without firing a shot.
No, you can't win that one, Mark. I'm sorry.
Well, there you go. And then if I told you... But the team they play for is Geelong. You'd have to start giving them a chance, wouldn't you?
14-8 to 11-3. 11-3, Port Adelaide on their home ground. And while you will wax lyrical and admire, as we always do, the best half-back flanker I've seen in my...
I know what you're going to say.
He is a ripper. While you want to focus on him and his, not his ageing cohorts in Lonergan and Taylor...
I know who you want to talk about. The lad we had in here?
Oh, well, he was superb.
Jared Rivers?
He was superb. Fantastic. I gave him a vote. He was superb. But, so while we say the norm is the norm, and even Corey Enright is starting to reinvigorate and get a bit of excitement, he's a bit flat early on in the year.
Yes.
The soon-to-be coach, assistant coach, because he's been ordained by Jared Rivers, hasn't he? Both of them are going to coach.
Well, they're both getting their credentials in order.
I'm going to give you some names.
There's one other guy in that back line. He's got a famous surname, but he's...
No. I'll put him in a bracket with the highly well-known Corey Gregson, right? Jackson Thurlow.
Well, hang on. With a name like Corey, you've got to play for Geelong.
Yeah. Thurlow. Buse, you've mentioned, wearing Dad's number 24.
I like Ted Buse. He's got great judgment.
Darcy Lang. You have the Blixarves factor, and while I'm on that, can I just talk about, did I hear on the radio coming in with the superlative tones of Stephen J. Peake that there's some angst about the third man up?
Yes, there is.
Well, I'll tell you what, if you take away the third man up, what's the main concern with the rulemakers? Stoppages, congestion. So if you take away Goddard's third man up and Blixarves' third man up, who do clear the ball wonderfully from stoppages,
you
will go back to more stoppages. So whoever brought that up, can you just forget about that? Is it an art of the game? As long as there is not interference or blocking, it is legitimate. It's been going on since Bull Richardson and Serge Silvani used to do it, and Alan Morrow did it with Dittrich. So,
and I agree, which is why I say there shouldn't be third up at boundary throw-ins. Because that is only there intended for blocking and interference.
Yeah,
and
you can block that. Yeah,
and Reece Stanley did it beautifully on Friday night. And it was well pointed out by former Cat Cameron Ling that...
It is quite exciting, though, Mark. The third man comes up and knocks it clear to the running five or the running circle.
But Reece Stanley did everything and then bailed out at the last minute, having almost not blocked his opponent. Lobie just seemed to be going to the wrong body. And Reece Stanley sort of ran him under the ball. Look, if you can do that, that's clever. But I don't mind the notion of two ruckmen up at a boundary throw-in.
Yes.
Around the ground, third up, fourth up, you're right.
Yeah.
Punch it, clear it, get it away. But if there's a protected area for the ruckman, I think the ruckman should be given a protected area at boundary throw-ins.
Okay. I'm happy with that.
And let two of them,
for the centre square.
Yeah, and let two of them compete after goals and from boundary throw-ins and around the ground, free for all.
Just, I think it's an art form. It's a way to clear the stoppages.
Yeah.
Nothing wrong with that. So their young
ones were terrific. And it would deprive us of the best ruckman in the competition, Jordan Lewis.
Well, there you go. That's fantastic.
Like, he does knock the ball away. He's a beauty. So
they've stuck with these young blokes. They've committed to them. That was the thing that stood out to me, and I tweeted it watching the game. It's fantastic. Identify your young players and have the courage to keep them in the side. I think Gregson's been in since day one. Thurlow came in a little bit later. I reckon Lang might have been left out the odd time. The development of Blixarves has been extraordinary, as we've seen. Murdoch's been important to them when Mitch Duncan's gone down.
How about the unusual Kirsten, who came on a sub?
It was an unusual... Did they lose someone before the first game? Because it's usually an unusual sub-role for the big...
they don't mind doing it. Geelong's a team that plays that sub-role. We had a return to the permanent large forward pocket. But he kicked a couple of goals and actually picks the ball up really well.
Clever.
I just think that he's a smaller man in a bigger man's body. You know, some footballers are like that. That they just like Glenn Archer was a big man in a small body. Kirsten doesn't play big, but he is big. Now,
Enright will become...
Corey, you've been asked a fair question here. What's wrong with Port?
Well, I don't see enough of them. I know we should. They've lost an extraordinary amount of last quarters when they've been well in the game. This game was They were a couple down. Geelong kicked 2 goals, 1 in the last quarter. Now, if you said that, on top of all the things you said at the start, Kelly and this bloke's out and he got injured and he got all that sort of thing, and Geelong will kick 2 goals, 1, playing away in the last quarter, right?
I've seen plenty of them.
They're disjointed. They don't play. I know it's a very broad statement. They don't play as an organised team. They still rely on Gray to have a big game. They rely on Wingard to be exhilarating, exciting, which he was. And he kicked 4 goals, and they all gave him a vote. The only problem is his team got belted, so it's pretty irrelevant, really. They just don't look like an organised, functional team that can run out games.
Hamish Hartlett looks injured to me. He's nothing like the player he was last year.
Mm.
Robbie Gray is being focused on, quite rightly, by opposition pre-planning as a must-lockdown player. He's not getting enough coverage and support from his teammates. Maybe we underestimated the role Kane Corns was doing in those stoppages and to make space for a Robbie Gray. I don't know whether that's
We don't know, but you've got to consider that factor.
And the players they bring in on a weekly basis are all too small. They seem to have a similarity about them that is definitely being exploited by the opposition. And that similarity is they all look like they're 5'11" and 75 kilos. Calhoun, yes. Sam Gray. Jake Need can come in, except he wishes he was 5'11 and 75 kilos. He's even smaller.
I was going to say White, but he's been pretty important. And yeah, he did his hamstring.
White's important, but they've got a rotating... Their bottom six, obviously,
are rotating small.
They're obviously not strong enough. Archie, Aaron Young isn't small, but he struggled yesterday. Their bottom six have not taken the next step. There was a group that did, that included Homps and Pittard. Yeah, they did really well to become bottom six into good footballers, but this bottom six is not stepping up. No Pollack, also an important loss pointed out.
I think that Dom again, he's back. Yeah, that's critical.
It is critical, but teams lose midfielders. Come on, I mean, they've lost Pollack. They've got all the other guys. Ollie Wines is back playing. No, not good enough Port, and now they are desperately trying
to...
But we don't know why.
We still haven't answered the question. It's a really hard question.
I say their bottom six is too small. Not good enough.
Geelong belted them physically. They did belt them physically.
They have tried over and over to rotate this bottom six, and they simply aren't stepping up. And this coach, Ken Hinckley, gives players a chance, but these guys, the bottom six, they named themselves on Friday night, have had many chances, and they don't seem up to the standard set by the side over the last 2 years. A break, and when we come back, I will set up the second hour of Inside Football.
On 11.16 SEN, we're first at the footy every Sunday morning.
From a tactical point of view, it was very smart, and he had very experienced players against two very inexperienced boys.
With full-on footy analysis.
Consistency and all that is fantastic, but at some time during a game, you have to stand up as a coach and say, I'm going to make this move. I'm going to change the course of the game from my position as a coach.
Welcome to Inside Football with Robert Shaw and Mark Fine. For McDonald Merhome, the employment lawyers, 9650 4555.
Welcome back. Inside Football, the full-on look at footy with Robert Shaw right through to midday. And as I said, we then go to the MCG. Will be a great build-up with a look at the weekend's footy from Rowan Connolly, Scott Lucas, Andy Marr and Nathan Thompson, and then on to a fascinating game. GWS have not had a lot of exposure at the MCG, and they play a defining game against Collingwood. Will it be GWS, the men that we see them growing into and have for most of the season, or for a couple of times this year, they've looked like the young boys still finding their way in the game? Collingwood will be a stern test, not an overly... Well, when I say experience, they're not by years old themselves, but they do know the MCG and they know what it takes to provide that test. It'll be a fascinating game of football. And then Melbourne St Kilda, can the Demons break a horrible run of outs at Etihad Stadium? It's been not only Etihad Stadium that has proved bridge too far for the Demons, but also the Saints. They haven't beaten St Kilda since 2006, when Was that Grant Thomas's last game of coach for the Saints? So the last time they lost to St Kilda, Grant Thomas was coach. Well, that was three coaches back. So they've got history against them, but St Kilda has their own cross to bear and have not started favourite in any games this season. They have been the hunter and done okay. How will they go, if not the hunted, then being on an even par with another side? It'll be another fascinating game. All coming to you on 11:16 SEN. But right now, let's check in with John Ralph. Good morning, John. How are you?
Well, I was good until you just made a really compulsive case for Collingwood and St Kilda, given I've tipped both of the underdogs in those clashes. And I've sort of put my tipping cojones on the line. I'm feeling positively queasy now.
I think in both cases, there are, for the teams that you've picked, their best football, their brightest selves in 2015 will win. But we've seen in both cases, and the opposition probably tests their mettle, because Collingwood will not exploit, but they will ask of these young GWS players, can you play the sort of football that the MCG demands, maybe even in September. So that'll be a test. And then St Kilda will hunt Melbourne, and under pressure, they haven't been great. So we'll see whether Melbourne and GWS can stand up. But before we look forward, looking back, and North Melbourne last night would have loved to have Dal Santo and Wells, and their fans are asking, when, John, when?
Well, I've got updates for you on Dal Santo. He is raring to go. And look, I think he was desperate to play. He knew what a big clash this would be. And maybe he might have got them across the line, but they've given him, well, a couple more weeks given the bye. The problem is Wells. 4 or 5 weeks was the best estimate from Darren Crocker last night. That was still a 4 or 5-ish, though. Now, like, you get the feeling that they initially said to themselves, we'll just take as long as we can and we'll build him up for 4 or 6 weeks before the finals. The problem is finals. If they continue to drop games like that, that they might not be there. So whether they pull the trigger at some stage and say, we just need to get him back, or whether they say, as they have before, he's a Rolls-Royce and we only pay him at 100%, well, that's a question that still needs to be answered.
There's a big difference between Dan Hannabry going down injured and Dan Hannabry staying off the ground. Now, he was off for a few minutes. He is as tough. I love Dan Hannabry's resilience in football, and you really need to be hurt. He needs to be hurt to spend any time off the ground. So I was concerned. What is the story with what looks like maybe a very deep cork?
Well, that's exactly the case. And it's the kind of injury where he would have been in intense pain. They gave him a bit of a massage. That wouldn't have really helped. And then he came back out, kicked the goal early in the last term. Club says he's pulled up well, so they would expect that he'd be okay for the next couple of weeks. The only other concern was Heath Grundy with that little medial strain of the knee, but he got through as well. I think that's what the intangible, a player like Dan Hannabry, he does what it takes. A player like Daniel Wells, we all love him and he's best, but he doesn't seem to be ready to go when he's not absolutely firing on all cylinders.
Yeah, points well made. Let's go to the Gold Coast, who were full. Their effort yesterday was full of merit. It was a really interesting game, and unfortunately, they keep getting injuries, but this time there might be something coming back the other way.
Oh, no doubt. They've got 4 players coming back after the bye, and the only real question for Rocket Eadie is how many of them come straight back into the senior side. Now, at this stage, all signs point to Gary Ablett coming back with that shoulder. Stephen May will come back from a groin, and both of those you would expect would play in the senior side. Now, they've also got Danny Stanley, who's out for between 4 and 8 weeks, but some of those reinforcements also include Rory Thompson with that hip pointer or hip flexor. And I think the other one is Swallow, who comes back with a knee. So both of those latter two are likely to come back through the knee fall. But at least they've got a couple of those younger kids who seem to have played so well in Boston and Shade and those kind of guys who can hold up an end for another week while they do play in the knee fall. So 4 back and 1 to miss with Stanley, which would be about 4 to 8 weeks, Rodney Eade said.
Charlie Dixon belted somebody in a marking contest who probably will get away with it, but His best way of winning back coach's favour will be attack on the ball, not the opponent, I would have thought.
No, no doubt. We saw a few of those. Nothing really from the match review panel, but a few blokes with some really heavy spoils. And again, you know, I think we've only seen 14 players suspended through the whole season, so it's just on 1 a week. So nothing that I saw that I'd see blokes suspended, but we're getting some pretty rough and tough spoils.
There's plenty of room at the inn if you're an Essendon player wanting to come back to the side through injury, you should be able to slot straight back in, I would have thought.
Yeah, you're right. Now, the one that will come in, you would think, would be Sean McKernan, given he's actually eligible now. One, after the bye, each club is able to elevate another one of those rookies, so he should play. Now, a couple of others that are ready, according to James Hurd last night, are Heath Hocking, who's had that groin issue for months now, and also David Myers, who we know dislocated his shoulder, and I think he had some surgery. But certainly he should be right as well. So again, with those guys, it's an issue of whether they come back through the Bendigo, through the Essendon of the AFL. And again, they've got three ruckmen to choose from, given all of Bell Chambers and Giles and McKernan all kicked, 11 between them. But 16-1 at the centre square hit out, so that's changed up the mix again. They're just plugging the holes in the dike.
James Kelly went off early. It looks like something on sort of the top of the ankle. What do we know what it is?
Well, officially they call it a high ankle sprain. So some of those can be the sesamoid, you know, where the ligament holds together the bones. He did actually grab at his knee first, and then he grabbed his ankle. So I think we're all a bit confused, but he has made the diagnosis, or he's been told by the docs it'll be between 3 and 8 weeks. So some scans tomorrow will ascertain the actual damage there. He's been playing some reasonable footy. He's averaged, I think, 21 touches. So he's one of those guys that'd be really keen to get back before the honest conversations. Bartel, again yesterday and again today on game day, has effectively ruled himself out for Boris's 300th, Corey Enright. So a lot of these clubs are just making conservative decisions before the bye. So you'd think they'd beat Melbourne and then they'd at least have Bartel back. Stanley's the only other one that we haven't got a lot of an update on. You know, it is foot soreness. Whether it's a sprain, whether there's a little, I was going to say navicular, whether there's a little metatarsal that's a bit bruised, we don't really know. But everyone gets concerned when Stanley's injured, and everyone gets concerned when it's a foot, because both of those things can add up to a bit of time on the sideline.
Straight after the game, Ken Hinckley suggested that Matt White's hamstring was of the serious nature, and that's been confirmed.
Yeah, that's right. So it'll be at least 4 weeks. He was carried all the way off, and again, I think that was more about the fact that his injury occurred all the way across the other side of the ground. And so, look, there's no doubt that he hasn't had a hamstring since late in 2013 when he missed the Richmond finals. But again, he's one of their prime movers. So, like with the fast twitch fibres there, you'd think he'd be a 4 or 5 weeker, reduced only by 1 week of the bye. So he probably still misses 4 weeks.
There's going to be a big game. It's next week. It's your Tigers against West Coast, and Richmond could be well served because Drew McGovern is so important to the Eagles. Two or three times they tried to bring him back or keep him on the ground yesterday. It was a fight against the impossible. Not only did he have a bad corky, but he also had a hand problem as well. So 6 of 1, half a dozen of the other, they seem to be unlikely to see him next week.
Well, you're more eloquent than I, and your diagnosis is better than mine. What's a double cork finding? Because that's what Adam Simpson called it. Now, I assume he had a cork, which is upon a cork. But all those things, and I think it was eventually diagnosed as a wrist problem there. All those things should put paid to him. He's only got 6 days, yet again, 2 6-day breaks. And, of course, Richmond have a 15-day break. The only interesting one will be Chris Newman for Richmond as well. Now, I think he played one game in the VFL coming back from an injury. So I think he said himself, look, it might be tough for me to get back into that back six. I think at his best, he's definitely in the Richmond 22, but that might be one to watch at selection this week for the Richmond.
I've got no idea what a double cork is, but two positives make a negative. I doubt whether two corks make an injury-free Jeremy McGovern, and he's so important in their back line. The question then will be whether or not Jack Darling, who was being sounded out as a possible defender during the pre-season, or prior to the pre-season, prior to breaking down, whether they have to use him back of centre because they are going to be stretched.
No, they will, and I'm sure Richmond will play three tools. Last time out, all of those tools were really effective. Look, they've got a couple of options there. Is Barras an option there that has been spoken of? But look, none of those guys have played a lot of senior football, so no doubt Richmond will try and stretch them and try and run them off their legs. You think about all of the West Coast tools, though, next year with Schofield and McKenzie and Brown coming back. But they are going to be a force to be reckoned with, given all those young emerging midfielders. So, I think we wrote them off at times last year, but they look pretty bright for the future, and Adam Simpson's coaching career looks pretty bright.
We're about to talk about them, and also the return to absolute full firepower for Mark Lacroix, because when he broke down about 3 years ago, got injured 3 years ago. He was closing in on one of the elite footballers in the competition to the point where, I think in that pre-season game where he got injured, he was playing forward and midfield. They thought that he could be brilliant in both, as in both roles. Well, he's back to his best, and isn't that exciting to watch?
Oh, it is. And look, I think we've all been guilty of thinking maybe Lucara's gone. He had a nasty forearm injury. He broke it, and then he broke it again, and then he carried a plate and a guard. And so I think it really affected his confidence. So you see him back at his best. You see Nick Natanui, who's finally over all those groin injuries and has actually been able to have a pre-season. Again, we thought Nick Natanui was a tease. He didn't look a tease last night or in the previous 10 weeks. So we're finally getting to see West Coast at their best, and it's pretty bloody good.
If they didn't have those two defenders go down, I mean, Will Schofield's a great second or third defender, but had McKenzie not gone down, then this substantially improved team might have improved all the way up into the top echelon. I don't think they're quite there yet, but we'll wait and see. Match review panel, pretty quiet?
Yeah, not too much. Again, I went through the stats at the midweek. Match day reports or reports are down 40%. 22 blokes reprimanded, so that means most of those blokes are eligible for the Brownlow, which they weren't last year. So it's been a pretty positive. Only three reports gone through to the tribunal, so I think we've all sort of enjoyed the fact that we haven't had to gnash our teeth about a million sort of incidents, but it also shows the players are learning, they're pulling their heads in as much as some have been reprimanded. So, yeah, a pretty good set of numbers, as P. Keating would say.
And finally, any word on a former Saint, now Port Adelaide's list manager, the very popular Jason Cripps?
Well, he's still in hospital and he's being monitored. This one came up yesterday afternoon, and myself and Emma Quayle were calling Port Adelaide quite early, and they just had to get their set of facts right. And so I think it's quite clear that he's had a heart attack, and as we know, he did collapse, and at least he had people around him that were able to, well, if not resuscitate him, at least give him some care. So, obviously a fellow with young kids, and we all are absolutely hopeful that he just pulls up 100%, but nothing yet more than that he's comfortable in hospital.
Well, we do know that he's receiving the best of care, and we don't want to make any assumptions re his health other than to say that we wish him a speedy and full recovery. He's a much loved figure in two states at least, and of course with close family and friends monitoring the situation, it would be wrong of us to second guess. Thanks for that update, John, and all the other information garnered from the Medical Room and Match Review panel.
Thanks, Ronnie. Thanks, Shorey.
John Ralph there, SEN Herald Sun and Fox Football reporter. A break, and when we come back, Essendon headed over to the West, and be fair, in that first quarter, it was clear that this team that had been chastened had been probably still had their ears ringing from the paint-peeling spray they got from the coach after last week's performance against the Cats, came out and they meant business. The problem is their best and is their most desperate capable of doing the business? When we come back, a man close to the flame, former Bomber Robert Shaw, will talk us through how Essendon huffed and puffed but could not blow the house of pain down.
We're first at the footy every Sunday morning on 11:16 SEN. Inside Football, full-on footy analysis with Robert Shaw and Mark Fine. For McDonald Merhome, the employment lawyers, 9650-4555. And Epworth, better. Inside Football, the West Coast Eagles.
We're the Eagles, West Coast Eagles, and we're here to show you why.
Essendon.
See the Bombers fly up, up to win the premiership.
Mark been taken by Stanton, but still buried inside his defensive 50. Oh, Watson dropped the mark, turnover. Prittis, hand pass, Kennedy, already kicked one, 30 metres out, snap around the corner. He's got two. The Coleman medalist is enjoying the last quarter. We've gone 3 minutes. Kennedy's gone goal, goal. He's now got three.
Now, I thought for the most part we handled ourselves pretty well, and a bit fumbly early. What they were giving us and what we responded with was, I don't know, just warranted a tight tussle. That I think they had 97 tackles. So the pressure was there, and we weren't great with our ball use, but I thought we grinded away and found a way to have a reasonable win.
That was Adam Simpson speaking after the 50-point victory enjoyed by the West Coast Eagles. It was a blowout at the end. Let's not forget that at three-quarter time, only 14 points separated the two sides. West Coast 14-12-96. Essendon 6 goals 10-46 on the back of a 5-goal 4-1-goal 3 final quarter. That is, sorry, at three-quarter time, sorry, it was 25 points of difference. Pardon me, 25 points of difference at three-quarter time, but it was only 2 or 3 goals the difference, probably 20 minutes into that third quarter. The game was still, if not alive, then Essendon were still pushing and testing West Coast, at asking questions of them. And that highlight that we played at the top of the opener was the moment that the elastic band snapped. Joe Watson dropped a sitter, and it was preyed upon by the West Coast Eagles. Game over. This was a game out west that Essendon came clearly prepared and determined to show better selves. And certainly they started better than they did against the Cats. Well, they did, because they kicked the first goal, which was more than a minute and a half against Geelong, surely. And for that first quarter, they were good value, Essendon, but with a different structure, with Carlisle in the ruck, without a centre-half forward to speak of, with Danaher clearly the man to short-circuit for the long ball. It was a long way home at Subiaco to actually get a goal for Essendon. It was the commitment and the intent was there, but unfortunately all their best intentions really didn't amount to much, because there wasn't a lot to kick to up forward. They were hoping rather than having much to execute towards.
Yeah, very interesting game to watch because of the things you made out, Mark. They obviously left the slower, less possession ruckman at home in Bell Chambers, and hoping that Carlisle could at least compete with Natanui, but then move around the ground and win possessions, take Natanui forward. That didn't come to fruition. Carlisle's had 4 kicks and 6 handballs. He's, I think he had 2 inside 50s, so he wasn't able to hurt the scoreboard. And that manifests itself in a problem, because when he's tired and they want to take him forward, he is fatigued, Mark. Makes it very difficult to compete in the forward line as a tired ruckman. And the same thing with Joe Danaher, who was well handled by Will Schofield. You summed it up very well, and so did Simpson. They came to compete. They had 97 tackles. They were mostly in the game all the time. They were in the game physically and obviously emotionally after the performance of last week. And early they won a lot of the ball. Stanton had 9 in the first quarter, Watson 10, Merritt 8, Goddard 10. So they were winning plenty of the ball. But then it came back to efficiency. And I want to give you a stat on a bloke that had average stats, Matt. Mark, this bloke only had 14 kicks and 7 handballs. He only went inside 50 once. He had very poor game with tackling. He had 2. But Mark Lacroix had 12 scoring involvements plus the 4-3 that he kicked himself. So this was a highlight package, and you've highlighted his the class differential that he has brought, having come back from injury. Like, people look at, 14 kicks, 7 handballs and all that sort of thing. You didn't have a tackle. You had 1 inside 50. Look how much better he made his teammates. He was the class factor of the side. Essendon didn't want for effort. They wanted badly for structure up forward and system moving forward. And I'll give you some interesting stats about lack of confidence going forward or lack of system. You can make up your own mind. Joe Watson had 31 possessions, 2 inside 50s, Mark, 2. He's not going to hurt you with that. Goddard, 25 possessions, 1 inside 50. Collier, who was really important to them at that ground, was well held and only had 10 possessions. 1 went inside 50. And Zach Merritt, who's been a real highlight for Essendon with his, you know, his energy and the way he plays, he had 30 possessions for 1 inside 50. And we had Joe Danaher here a couple of weeks ago, and you asked him the question, when do your eyes light up? Who has the footy? And he said, you know, we're thinking, oh, you know, all the senior blokes. He said Zach Merritt. Well, the young fella had a very industrious game, worked hard, went inside 50 once. They went inside 35 times for a game on a ground that is a kicking game. It's you've got to kick there. You've got to make distance, not with your running and your handball. And Essendon have had 214 kicks and 200 handballs, Mark. So really overused the ball. We're indecisive going forward, and it's like an old record. This has been consistent of them. They do not have confidence in their forward structure. It is a continual... It's been Carlisle, a Danaher, Ambrose. They get McKernan back off the rookie list next week. He's kicked five. They've got to look at him as a mobile centre-half forward in the like of the, you know, the, he came from Adelaide. Jenkins went to Adelaide from Essendon. Have a look at McKernan as a pinch hitter and a ruck. Have a look at him at centre-half forward and see if he can straighten up the side. Their willingness to compete was there. Their possession was there. So their back line under extreme duress continues to stand up with Hooker and Hurley. Kennedy got three. Darling made a successful return to the team with two. So you had the two key forwards in Kennedy and Darling kicking five. Essendon's main goal kicker was the highly promising and really pleased they play him. We've been speaking about him on our show. Sean Edwards kicked two. He had 17 possessions and he had brought some life and some pace to a slow side. So let's hope that we see Sean Edwards for Essendon supporters' sake playing every game from now on. They are 4-7. They have a break. They then play Hawthorn. They're not going to match their aspirations of playing in the finals and winning a final. The competition's too hot for them. And obviously their forward structure's got to be looked at closely. Their back line, they've held the West Coast Eagles to under 100 points. They've successfully done that all year. So their defensive organisation and their back line has been superb. Their efficiency, system, style of play and effectiveness of ball use has been second rate this year and is the reason they are 4-7 on the ladder, Mark.
I want to go through a few of the Bombers. First of all, Brent Stanton, who cops the rounds from Essendon supporters. 31 touches, 22 kicks, 81% effectiveness, 9 tackles.
Worked hard. Worked really hard.
That's what you need to do there. You need to work hard. You need to cover ground. And he covered the ground, which was good.
It's a good balance of numbers. He won 9 contested possessions. He took 11 marks. So it shows he's working on the outside. His clearances were... where's his clearance? He had 5 really good clearances. It was a very, very strong and solid game. Better than strong and solid from Brent Stanton.
You know, I'm always interested in the players listed as best by journos, and if something's...
You love it, don't you?
If there's a sore thumb, I'd like to point it out. And Kim Hagdorn has named Joe Botson as Essendon's best. If Joe Botson was Essendon's best, and I'm not saying that he had a lot of pressure from others, but if he played better than Stanton and a couple of other players... And then I'm the monkey's proverbial uncle. This was not a good game by Job. This was a game in which he was bested, in which he made errors, in which he, as you pointed out, couldn't do the telling thing, which was get the ball inside 50. Brendan Goddard, time to keep, you know, just have a look at Brendan. And
well, you talk about him because you've seen him play 200 games.
Yeah, and I've seen his form rise and fall as well. So I'm not saying that this is time of diminishing returns from Brendan, because that has been the case through his career, that there have been periods where he has not played the sort of football that he can and he's bounced back from that. But the question is how to use Brendan Goddard best if he is starting, and he's the other side of 30, if he is starting to show the signs of age. We've got kids out there 18, 19 years old that are vibrant, fast, full of hassle, full of tackle, full of run. And if he's going to be blunted by running around with and against them in the midfield, he might well get exposed. So the question is best use for Brendan Goddard. You asked forward. He's never been a permanent forward and he doesn't play that, has never played that role. Maybe it's time to have a look at it, given Essendon's circumstances. Maybe an opportunity to get Danaher higher up the ground, to get involved further. He's such a good player, Danaher. He played well again yesterday. Travis Collier was very important earlier on in the season because he provided the speed that wasn't there in other players' legs. He needs to play out the season, doesn't he?
Collier?
Yeah.
Oh, there's no doubt about that. He's one that...
He needs a lift.
He had a disappointing game yesterday where he's been really encouraging throughout the year.
Not so encouraging last week, so maybe he needs the break.
But the Goddard thing's very interesting, Mark, because he's not quick. He's never been quick, but he's been one of the smartest players. He's back of the stoppage. He sits off the stoppage and he gets the ball. And when he does get the ball, he's not mobile, meaning he's not generally on the move. So he's in a stationary position with people hounding him, running down. So it's forcing him to kick across the ground or find the first target. I don't know how they can do it in an imaginement round structure, because he is important for that first receive or the first handball out of congestion. He just doesn't go inside. He's a great decision maker, a lovely kick of a football, but they've got to get him in a position where his kicking is hurting opposition. I don't think he's been even tagged. They're not even looking at him because they know his positioning doesn't allow him to use his greatest strength, which is his vision and his long kicking. If you're going to get 25, 30 every week and go inside 50 on a minimal occasions, they're not going to look at you, and he's not going to hurt the opposition. But it is a balance between confidence and that. You know, the Eagles always had confidence, even though there were some great duels up there with Kennedy, Hurley, Hooker and Darling and these sort of blokes. It gave them confidence to look up and lift their eyes and go forward. Essendon looking to manufacture, to move the ball forward with a lot of possessions. You know, the handball is far too much handball at the Subiaco ground. I've stated that it's a quick transition kicking game at Subiaco. But if you haven't got confidence in your forwards, or you haven't got a legitimate forward options that the opposition backline fears, they're going to be able to organise themselves and beat you on slow entries every time.
One other one for Essendon is Essendon play high possession game. They 400 plus possessions. They move the ball around. Yesterday it was a lot by hand as well as by foot. But if you're going to play that high possession game, Shorey, then you need players that work hard off the ball. They need to create space. They need to be offering themselves up for lead, sort of hit-up players that work, constantly running and working. Jake Melcham doesn't strike me as that sort of player, or at least he's not playing that sort of game. He's really good when the ball's, because he's got a strong body now and he's a real good attack. He provides good attack on the ball. But this is now the second or third time I've seen that the longer the game goes on, the more he sort of fades into the sunset.
He does fade out of games. Look,
because it seems as though the more he runs around trying to get the ball, the less his powers diminish during a game. Well, you can't have players whose powers clearly diminish during a game, because games are won often in the last quarter. The game's up for contest, and he's out of, is it petrol tickets? I don't know.
Well, I don't know about his fitness and his work rate, but I do know what they did with him early on and throughout their first 11 rounds, with Myers going down and Hocking not being available for selection. They did give him some very big tasks as a run with player, some of which he did very well. But it's been a 5 out of 10 season from Melkstrom. He would be one player that they would hope, like a lot of do it clubs, solid footballer, does some good jobs, play some good games, but the next level, can you take your game to the next level and be a legitimate midfield that can go forward? I think he's adjusted quite well to a change in roles. I think the role that they've given him has challenged him, and generally it's been a successful transition into the tagging role for Melcham, which has given him another string to his bow. I don't think it's been an unsuccessful year from him, but I think the opportunities have been there for him to take his game to the next level, and he hasn't quite been able to do that. And you've raised that running fitness, you know.
That's what the game plan requires, and maybe the more...
I don't know enough about him in that area, so yeah. I can't really comment.
Just a question,
but
Mark.
But we can look and see. We can only comment on what we see.
Speaking of question marks, big thumbs up to what Adam Simpson has got out of three players that surely must be have been on their last West Coast football leagues, if not their last AFL football leagues. Jared Wellingham, going all right.
transformed to a, well, that's the point. Point in case. Yep. What was he? A midfield sort
forward,
of
popgun, well, forward, popgun forward. Popgun forward. Now an account.
Bit of a tagger, and now a critical,
accountable player off the half back line and
one,
run.
That, well, that's one.
Yeah,
that's coaching. That is coaching.
Tosh Hill, he is a popgun forward, but at least he's the gun's going off more often than not, and he's playing. And also Brad Shepherd, the invisible man of league football, sixth year in the system, 59 games.
Butler.
Butler's a bit. He's played in the premiership team.
Played in the premiership team 10 years ago.
He's got a very big body. He's had injuries. Butler's fair enough. But Shepherd has just been marking time. And under Adam Simpson, he's been given a role off the back line, maybe because of injuries doing it well. We need to take a break. And when we come back, 7-6. Gold Coast
one.
Outscore
Fremantle.
The Dockers, sort of.
We're first at the footy every Sunday morning on 1116 SEN. Inside Football. Full-on footy analysis with Robert Shaw and Mark Fine. For McDonald Merhome, the employment lawyers, 9650-4555. And Epworth. Better. Inside Football. The Gold Coast Suns.
Fremantle. Robinson now puts it up inside the 50. Pavlich and Pfeiffer both there. Fife takes it, turns around, goes bang, and puts to another goal.
It made it a bit harder than it should have been, but thrilled with our character in the last quarter. At the end of the day, we turn at the break 10-1. We get a week off to gather ourselves. They have 5 days of R&R or whatever it is, and come back pretty invigorated about the second half of the year.
Ross Lyon, he should be pleased, because in the end, when you've got a desperate team in greasy conditions in front of a small but parochial home crowd surging at you for a win on the back of your first loss of the season, with the bye beckoning, might be easy just to roll over and lose that game. There were plenty of mitigating factors. Well, not mitigating. There were plenty of factors that played against the Dockers. They won, though. 6-17-53. They didn't kick as many goals as Gold Coast, who kicked 7-4-46. But they did have 23 scoring shots to 11. In front of, I'll give full credit to Fox for how they amplified the crowd, because 8,911 in the last quarter sounded like an MCG-type crowd. They were into it. Those that were there, that braved the conditions, those Gold Coast fans saw a home team put their best foot forward, and they can have no complaints with the effort. But when you've got Sanderlands to Fife, an extraordinary thing happened. There was this period in that last quarter where they were within a goal of winning the game. So they were 4 points down, Gold Coast, for about 8 minutes, and that entire time the ball was in the Fremantle forward 50. They just could not score. Fremantle made the same mistake over and over. In the end, it got to a goal the difference, because a couple of points were scored, but they kept kicking the ball to the top of the square. Now, on a wet and greasy day, with plenty of height getting back in defence for Gold Coast, that ball was always just going to be punched through. And it took, in the end, it by weight of numbers, by dint of possession, by dint of strength, they got over the line. It also took McFarlane to be resolute in defence. It took Sanderlands winning a record 71 hit-outs, most of which went down the neck of Fife, to really settle the argument. But interestingly, they got 12 points up Gold Coast, game over with 50 seconds to go. No, not game over. Gold Coast still had one more goal in them. It was amazing. They still kicked another goal. So the ball went back to the middle with 23 seconds to go. No Carmichael Hunt or Richmond to play against, but a goal the difference. And quite rightly, the broadcaster's trying to keep the excitement up. It needs to be the perfect play for... It was almost hilarious. It was almost comical. It needs to be perfect. What they need to do is they need to get the hit out and get the first kick and get it inside 50. Well, that was about as likely as happening as the Titanic resurfacing with the band playing, because all they had to do was deny a man who had had 70 hit-outs his 71st hit-out. Well, that was never going to bloody happen. So, of course, Sandilands hit the ball straight down the throat of Fife, who kicked it forward, and they, in fact, kicked a point. But it was funny. All they need to do is win this hit-out. They're not going to.
No. Mark, I'm going to ask you some. I did not see this game. I've got a good SMS here for you. Finneas Ross Lyon got the management, not the list management, all wrong. The list is very heavy on 29-plus, and bar injuries kept them all in. Why did Sandilands travel fly over 5.5-plus hours? Well, I think Ross Lyon said they're going to get 5 days off now. So linked to that good SMS, could they have left him home and played, exposed their depth a little more? It sounds as if they did leave them home, they would have lost their game. Now, linked into that, with the 5 days rest at the halfway mark, do you believe that Lyon will take the opportunity at some stage to rest his players again, a la the situation we had where he rested about 12 last time? Or can he go all the way now with this list based on a half-year break?
Knowing Ross Lyon as we do, if the ladder allows, he will. This is what they are playing for, top two. This is how the top eight breaks down. You play for top two, and then for top four, and then six, then eight. You want all the chances afforded to you with a home final run through top two. If with five rounds to go, it is a mathematical certainty that they will finish top two. That may be the case. There could well be a space, if they keep winning, put between them and the third team, even though unlikely, because Sydney and Hawthorn will chase them hard. But if Hawthorn mucked up a couple of times, they might have, in the last 5 weeks, a chance to have a week off en masse, which is what he has done twice in his career, once with Fremantle against St Kilda and once with St Kilda against Hawthorn down in Tasmania. And he's done it all in 1 week for the group of players. You can all have basically a sabbatical, a little period off, and then you can come back, and really done that for most of the team. Oh. Otherwise, Ross Lyon has coached two clubs where all that matters is winning a premiership. It's well and good after the fact for St Kilda supporters to say, well, he left us in a state of disrepair because he only ever played his best 22. Well, we demanded it because we hadn't won a flag since 66, and he wasn't in a position to get all schmancy-fancy with playing different players. So had St Kilda, like Geelong, won a flag, then I'm sure he would have been expansive. This SMS asks why Blakely, Ballard, Langdon, Duffy and Griffin haven't been rewarded for playing well in the waffle. Because Freo's never won a premiership, and he's in no position to be creative until they break that duck. That's what the fans demand. That's what the committee demands. That's what he was hired for. That is his modus operandi. So you get a week off with Ross Lyon, if mathematically it's impossible to miss the top two at some point in the year, within about 4 weeks at the end of the season, because he would not want to do it and flirt with form in the last couple of weeks of the home and aways.
I know time's running out, Mark, but there's three SMSs.
No, we've got to fly.
Oh, righto.
Otherwise,
Goddard,
we're in big trouble.
Goddard, demonstrative, demanding leadership, or this is off the SMS, or blame proportioning. You've known him.
He's driven, demanding, and he's brilliant when he does it. If he's not pointing and yelling at players, then you start worrying.